playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. There was a turgid diet of Brexit stalemate, not to mention a parade of presidential hopefuls across the airwaves this week. Cormac O'Hara kicked off the debates on RTÉ Radio 1 last Saturday lunchtime. Claire Byrne Live turned up the heat on four candidates on RTÉ television on Monday. And then Pat Kenny hosted the first television debate featuring all six candidates on Wednesday on Virgin Media 1. While Michael D. Higgins is way ahead on the polls and is on course to secure a second term as president, accusations of extravagant spending in Áras an Uachtaráin were still flying, and millionaire dragon Peter Casey was still cutting up rough with his incendiary remarks on travellers and halting sites.
So let's start with the most important question for a prospective president of Ireland. How close to travellers do you live, Peter Casey?
Far too close, within a dog's whistle of me.
Sean Gallagher, why do you want to be president?
This country has gone through enough. It is time to end my 7 years of hurt.
Liam Arida?
Och, tisha again a jock-like.
John Freeman, what are your policies?
Darkness into light. Walk right back to happiness.
Gavin Duffy, why do you want to be president?
It's Lord Lieutenant Duffy, but let me answer this question a different way, Pat. Why do you want one of us to be president?
Yeah, Michael D. Higgins?
This is very distasteful. One doesn't have time for such trifling discourse. My leadership is wishing in the car park.
Leonie Rida, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you love the IRA?
Ara, that's 20 years ago, Pat. You keep bringing them back.
No, I'm bringing sexy back.
I want to be a gentleman and give my time to Joan. She never gets a look in.
Shut up, I don't need your rescuing.
Michael D, do you want to come in here?
One didn't want to come here at all.
Okay, some one-liners.
Ara, more can he look?
I'm a walking, talking Sunday World front page.
I'm the son of a pig farmer.
Well, so is Slab Murphy, isn't that right, Leah?
Oh, it's my lummish beanie.
Michael D, what will you do for another 7 years?
Well, I think it's very important to existentialise the conscience of our internal being.
What?
The withering of the id.
Sorry?
The perspicacity of the gloaming.
I am the most Irish of the candidates here, for I am the manifestation of a 7-year stew of begrudgery.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we've time for here on Virgin 3, whatever it is. Thank you to all the candidates.
I don't need thanking.
Best of all, thank you for watching me. Thank you and good night. Good night.
Thank you for that.
From Callan's kicks last night, well, never a dull moment. Yesterday it emerged that Peter Casey is rethinking his run for the Áras.
Lee's hand, I think you've been on the campaign trail with Peter Casey. Might you have been wasting your time in view of the fact that he's now taking the weekend to reflect on whether he should continue?
Well, I'm not going to totally despair that my time is wasted yet, because I am taking this with a slight pinch of salt. When he was on the canvas yesterday, he had been telling various journalists that he was going to play golf for the weekend and he was going to attend a GAA match, and he wasn't planning to campaign anyway. I was asking him, was there any other group that he had in mind to pick on next week after he had to go with the Travellers this week? And he launched into a massive diatribe about broadband and how he was going to go after ComReg next week and various related 4G issues about rural broadband and so on. So, I mean, this was a man with a plan less than 24 hours ago, and, you know, he had a strategy. Now, it is possible that when he saw the Taoiseach coming out and being extremely trenchant in his criticism of his remarks, and which were also echoed this morning by the Tánaiste, you know, various newspapers having a go, you know, he could genuinely be thinking about this. But yeah, I'm not sure that, given that he is playing for the Trump playbook, John, that this isn't a stunt.
Hugh O'Connell, I do not want the people of Ireland to elect me as president just based on one statement I made. Now, yeah, it was probably a bit of a long shot to expect that to happen anyway, but he can't actually take his name off the ballot paper, can he?
No, he can't. No, his name will be on the ballot paper next Friday, no matter what he does over the next few days. But, I mean, you'll note as well, at the end of his statement, he talks about how he believes he's suitably, I think he says he's uniquely qualified to be president of Ireland, that he has the skills and capabilities. Whilst he's taking the weekend off to go golfing, attend a GAA match, I still think that he'll be active next week. He'll undoubtedly, I think, show up at the primetime debate on Tuesday and any other debates that are due to take place between now and polling day. So in an election where it looks, for all intents and purposes, as if the incumbent is on course for landslides, the other candidates are struggling for relevancy. They have to make as much noise as possible, and Casey has chosen, rightly or wrongly, to go down this route of creating as much noise as possible. And it's worked, because he's been the centre of attention the last few days.
journalists Hugh O'Connell and Lise Hand with Sean O'Rourke yesterday. An hour later, an upset Peter Casey was interviewed by Áine Lawler on the News at One, and he confirmed that he will make up his mind by Monday. Graham Norton left West Cork in the 1980s to find fame and fortune on British television as a chat show host, but he also writes like a dream and has just published his second novel. It's called A Keeper and was inspired by a story his mother told him about life and love in a small town. Graham was Ray Darcy's guest on Monday, and somehow the conversation turned to his own love life and his forays onto the dating app Tinder.
Speaking of dating...
Oh, yes, Ray.
Yeah, see what I did there.
What are you going to tell me?
So you've said that you're off Tinder and Grindr and everything. And what was your quote? It's full of broken people. Is that what you said?
No, see, I felt very bad saying that. Because, of course, when you're doing these things, my mouth opens yeah. and old guff comes out and I walk away. Then somebody writes it down and prints it in a newspaper as if I held a press conference saying, Tinder, full of broken people. It's full of people. And some of them, and I met some of them, are broken, but I also met some very nice people on Tinder. And Tinder is, it's a great thing. And like I say, what I like about it is there's so much trust involved in all of that. You know, the fact that you are going to go and meet a complete stranger and you both assume that neither of you has got a gun in your bag. It makes you feel better about the world that actually, you know, most people aren't serial killers or, you know, horrific people.
It's hard to believe
they're nice. They might be a bit broken or a bit boring, but yeah, there's no crime in that.
It's hard to believe that you were on Tinder. Like, your face is there, writ large, beard, there you go.
All right, Ray.
No, but like, guys,
a few people swiped right or left from what the hell it's supposed to do.
No, what I mean is...
Not everyone went,
ugh. No, I mean what I'm saying is you are Graham Norton. You are very well known.
Yes.
Yes.
I can't pretend that I'm not Graham Norton, who's well known. Yeah. You know, if I meet someone in the street, they'll probably know it too. Yeah. So there's nothing I can do about that. That is the reality of who I am. And you do have to second guess that people might be meeting you differently.
Yes.
I did go on a date once and the guy seemed really nervous. I mean, like sweating and shaking nervous. And he said in his message, oh, we'd met previously at this other thing. And I said, oh, how come we were at that thing? And he went, oh, my flatmate is a journalist for the Daily Mail. Now, one, don't tell me that. And two, of course, alarm bells go off. And then, bless him, he had obviously been given a list of questions by his flatmate to try and work into conversation. So you're doing the normal kind of thing. Oh, you know, do you have brothers and sisters? And, you know, what do you do? And do you travel? Where you know, whereabouts in London do you live? And, da, da, da. And then he'd suddenly go, have you ever presented your chat show drunk? And so it becomes clear quite quickly who's really on a date and who's got an ulterior motive. Him I found sort of endearing because he was so bad at it.
Graham Norton heard on the Ray Darcy Show on Monday. Well, yesterday, Ryan Tuberty's guest was Hollywood legend and Oscar winner Michael Caine, star of hit films Alfie, The Italian Job, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. In fact, he's over 100 movies to his credit. He's 85 now and has just written his third autobiography. It's called Blowing the Bloody Doors Off and Other Lessons in Life.
When you became a big star, talking about the 1960s and swinging London and the Stones and the Beatles and Gene Shrimpton and your flatmate Terence Stamp, all hanging out, it feels like a halcyon time now looking back, I can imagine. But did you feel all the time that there was a snobbery about the place, that people were slightly looking down their nose?
No, what we felt before, we felt people were looking down their nose and we cared. The people kept looking down their noses in the 60s, we didn't care anymore. Because we created our own power. We created everything, right through to our own restaurants and coffee bars, you know? But no one set out in the 60s to do the 60s or three. I certainly never had any. All I wanted to do was to become the best actor I could possibly become, you know? But we were fortunate because what happened at the same time was working class writers started writing. Bill Norton wrote about Alfie, a working class boy. Working class actors, Albert Finney, Peter O'Toole, Sean Connery all became movie stars, you know. But none of us did it with an idea, this is what we're going to do. And we didn't have meetings about how we get on with politically against the snobbery and all this. And we just did our own thing. But we were a generation, if you remember, the oldest ones of them was people like me. I was born in the Depression. When I was 6, a war broke out. When I was 12, the war ended. And then for the next 10 years, all we had was smog and rationing in the 50s.
Yes.
When I was 18, I was sent off to war and fought in Korea. And then when I came back at 20, we were in the 60s.
Sure.
And Khrushchev said, I have an atom bomb. You have 4 minutes to live if I drop this on your city. So we thought, well, if we've only got 4 minutes to live after all this we've been through, let's have some fun. And that's how the 60s were born. And that's all it was. That's all it was. We just said, sod it. Sod everybody. The BBC wouldn't play pop music. The snobbery of that, they had in the BBC, they had newsreaders on radio wearing evening suits.
Yes.
On radio.
Yes.
Wearing evening suits. They wouldn't play pop music. We listened to Radio Luxembourg, the American Forces Network, and then finally we had a ship off 3 miles off out of limits who played pop music for us, you know? So we had to overcome all those things. I mean, with food, we had the fish and chip shop, the eel and pie shop, and the pub and Lion's Corner House. That's all we had. In the 60s, we brought in Italian restaurants, which, you know, stayed open. You didn't have a dress code. You didn't have to wear a suit and a tie to get in, like the British restaurants.
Yes.
The food was excellent, unlike the British restaurants, which was crap, you know.
Yeah.
And so we created an entirely new life for ourselves without actually knowing what we were doing or intending to do.
Michael Caine with Ryan Tubridy yesterday. Like Mary Robinson before him, J.P. McMahon, the Michelin star chef of an Ear restaurant in Galway, is just the latest to say that we should be eating less meat and more shellfish, oysters and seaweed if we're to have any hope of saving the planet. He's one of the main movers of Food on the Edge, a festival that brings together Irish and international chefs, producers and suppliers to talk about the future of food. The festival is dedicated this year to the memory of the American celebrity chef and documentary maker Anthony Bourdain. J.P. McMahon was Sean O'Rourke's guest on Wednesday.
Now, an Ear opened in 2011. Not the easiest time economically to be opening a high-end restaurant. You won that coveted Michelin star just 14 months later. Now, what was that like? And did it put a lot of extra pressure on you? Because you're thinking of, you know, how am I going to retain this?
Oh, 100%. I mean, it was like an avalanche hitting the restaurant. I think we went from literally being able to take the reservations on our mobile phone while we ran through the restaurants to have to hire a receptionist. And, of course, expectation levels going up at international guests. And I mean, every year I think it's going to be less stressful retaining it, but we just retained it there. The pressure is always there. I suppose it's like playing the cup final every single night. Like if you lose, you lose. It does involve more labour cost, more food cost, and it is, I mean, it's terrible to say it's more of an experience, because every type of eating is an experience. But even in relation to our tapas bar, Cava, it would do 200 or 300 people a night with four chefs, and in an Ear we do 24 people a night with six chefs. And that's why always when people ask me the difference between 1, 2 and 3 stars is that the size of the restaurant stays the same and you just get more chefs. Like, so you, maybe for 3 star you would have 30 or 40 chefs for 40 people. And an Ear is a labour of love. I think most Michelin star restaurants are a labour of love. And usually, well, that's why we have our tapas bar, which does a lot of people. We have our little cafe and wine bar, Tartar, which is very informal as well. So I suppose we try and balance them off each other. And if anyone knows any of the great 3 star restaurants like Paul Bocuse's or any of those, they all have these other restaurants that help feed their project of love. Of course, my accountant thinks I'm insane, because last year I took 2 tables out of the restaurant and he said, you just took €400 a night out of your restaurant. And I said, yeah, but I'm going to make the tables bigger and it'll be nicer. But
the tables.
So, yeah. And I wouldn't mind taking another 4 out, but my wife said, there's absolutely not happening.
Chef J.P. McMahon, heard on the Today Show on Wednesday. Stellar by name and stellar in content, recorded in 3 days in 1968, Van Morrison's album Astral Weeks at 50 remains a thing of everlasting beauty. Last Saturday's documentary on One, produced by Alan Tourney and Tim Desmond, told the story of its making. And we join the action as Van and his wife, Janet Planet, have moved from New York to Boston, having escaped a very bad record deal he'd signed with the label linked to the Mafia. In the summer of 1968, a record company executive from Warner's saw him perform in a tiny folk club in Boston and decided to sign him up. The rest is history.
He was broke. He was living in Boston. And I had a call from the talent scout, and she told me about this guy who was tearing it up in Boston. And so I go to Boston, and I heard him sing.
I turn on the radio!
I still believe that's one of the greatest rock and roll vocalists I've ever heard. I knew I had to get him on the label. I found out what the story was. His contract was owned by a guy who had owed a lot of money to some strange guys, and they decided to sell me his contract. The deal was we had to give the managers $20,000 to buy his contract.
That's about 150 grand in today's money.
And deliver it to them on the ninth floor of a warehouse at night when it's dark.
You'll be all right, too.
So I took a taxi over there. I didn't think it was a good neighborhood for a limo. I get there, and there's a couple of guys downstairs at the door, and I'm walking up the stairs, certain that somebody's going to hit me in the head. But I gave it to the guy, $20,000 in cash, to sign Van Morrison to a contract.
As the summer of 68 was drawing to a close, Joe Smith had finally released Van from his Bang Records contract.
When we heard the news that Van was to sign with Warner's, we were ecstatic, jumping up and down, hugging, crying. I mean, so excited, so thrilled that he was going to get another chance. That's all I prayed for is, please, please, dear God, let this man find his audience. That's all I was asking for all that time.
Well, it took years before the album was recognised as a classic, but it now regularly appears in the best of lists. Brooks Arthur was producer-engineer on the recording.
Warren heard you noodling around, and then suddenly you guys, like, locked, and even Van was starting to, like, pick up on where you guys were. I usually communicate with the producer of the record date and letting him know when I roll tape. And in this case, I just felt some shit happening, some magic was happening. So I hit the red light. We're on the air, you know. Turns out that we made history, but we didn't know we were making history. We were just making a record, you know. But here we are 50 years later. Beside you was the gem, just the gem.
Little gem is gone. Away out on the back street. Out of the window to the falling rain. Right on time. Right on time. That's why Broken Arrow, with his finger down the road so dark and narrow in the evening, just before the Sunday six bells chime, hit all the doctor barking. Way out on the damp and studded highway where you wander. And you roam from your retreat and view. Way over on the railroad. Tomorrow while the tipping tracks will unload together. Every scrapbook stuck with glue. And I'll stand beside you. Beside you, child. To never, never, never wonder why at all.
Van Morrison, and you can listen back to the Summer of Astral Weeks, produced by Alan Torney and Tim Desmond on the RT Player. There was an ocean full of discussion about Brexit and backstops this week, a negotiation process that seems to be going nowhere fast. But over on Planet Oliver Callan, there's always an upside.
Well, Denny McGrorty here at McGrorty's Border Stores, hey, inviting you all to come down for the best border backstop value in town, hey. Whether you think a backstop is an abstract concept or an actual thing, we'll sell it to you at a price no one can beat, hey. We got backstops in all shapes and sizes. A backstop to beat the band. A backstop to beat your friends. A backstop to stop your back. A backstop to the backstop. Whatever the japers that is. All with free delivery within a 10-mile radius of the border. And don't forget our other great deals on green diesel. Cheap drink that's as strong as Sterling is weak. Big Tom Miraculous Medals. And 20 years of peaceful coexistence. And remember, next year if we run out of backstops, McGrorty's Border Stores, hey, will have a special Back to the Bad Old Days sale, including roadblocks, checkpoints, nervous young lads with M16s asking what your business is in Uri, beef smuggling, and a return to completely avoidable political violence that could tear the whole area apart, hey. That's McGrorty's Border Stores, as seen on Dundeal.ie and Crime Stoppers UK, serving all your backstop needs since 72. And new for 2019, all deliveries will come free with a 5-minute warning and a recognised code word. Hey.
From Callan's Kicks last night, Ryan Tuberty's conversation with Paul C. Dwyer was both fascinating and very scary. Paul is recognised worldwide as an expert on cybersecurity, working for the past 25 years with the military, law enforcement and with commercial companies, fighting crime on the internet's dark web, a space he refers to as a petri dish of hate and evil.
Some of the best cyber detectives in the world actually come from Garda Síochána.
Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Paul Gillen headed up Europol. We had Mick Moran. We have Michael Gubbins now in charge of the crime unit here in Dublin. You know, they don't have the resources, I will say, but what they do have is the ability and they have the drive and passion to deal with these crimes.
You mentioned ISIS there.
Yeah.
You hear people saying, well, ISIS, you know, our borders are very porous. But the next question is, do ISIS have a presence in this country, do you think?
100%.
100%.
100%.
And that is certifiable? It's evidence-based?
Certifiable. There's lots of evidence. So if you're fighting cybercrime, essentially you're fighting terrorism because the terrorists use cybercrime to make their money.
To buy the guns, to organise events,
everything else like that. So what we had is we had a cell operating from Ireland and parts of that cell are still here, cyber jihadis. And they talk about a cyber caliphate that they want to essentially spread the word right across the internet and control that. And this is how they radicalise children as well, online and the dark
and
web.
And recruit.
This is how they spread the word. This is how they're so effective on what they do. And they'll have a number of sleeper cells and then they can coordinate these people together. The invoice fraud that was carried out earned them about $2.5 million Dublin with one particular incident that was being run out of Santry. That money and the people behind that were the people behind the London Borough attack when they drove over London Bridge, went down, killed 8 people, stabbed 48 other people. And that is right back to Rashid Radoon, who was one of those and was living and working in Rathmines.
Where's he now?
He's dead.
He got shot.
He's one of those guys that was shot within minutes from that attack.
But the suggestion is he would have comrades, friends.
Absolutely.
Here.
And the guards are doing an awful lot of work in this area as well, with cooperation with Europol and everything else like that, to talk about this cyber jihadi problem we have here, essentially. Because if you think about our neighbours, they have secret services, they've MI5, MI6, GCHQ, and so on and so forth. We have a smaller resource base, and we don't have the laws to back up those resources. So what I'm talking about here is the Defence Forces, the M2 unit, the Garda Síochána. They don't have the resources or the laws to allow them to go on the offensive to find these things. In other words, to use what we call crimeware or malware, the tools used to investigate a lot of
times. So they're responsive rather than proactive because they can't fight or
defensive. And the other, other thing, Ryan, is that what crime does not involve a cyber element these days? Murder, or anything? Yeah. So the small resources that are there are actually dealing with all these kinds of stuff as well, and they're busy dealing with the child abuse imagery and all of that sort of stuff as well. So it's a case of prioritisation as well of those kinds of things. But we see more and more of that all the time. We see paramilitaries, organised criminals that may have worked in other kinds of areas now going over to cybercrime. It's very easy and very lucrative and very hard to get caught. And obviously I'm not endorsing it, but the fact is that's why it's become a $1 trillion economy.
Paul C. Dwyer heard on the Ryan Tubridy Show on Tuesday. One of America's most famous policemen was in town this week. Bill Evans retired as Boston's police commissioner this summer, having spent nearly 40 years in the force. He's probably best known for the key role he played in the capture of one of the Boston Marathon bombers in 2013.
Well, you know, I had run the race and I did it about 3:34 that day. So I finished an hour before the bombs and I was in the hot tub soaking my body when they ran in and told me two bombs had gone off. And right away I got in the shower and I was right back into work. And I always remember going back to the scene that I had just run down and seeing all those young kids, Martin Richard, Lindsay Liu, and the Campbell young lady, you know, their bodies. And it's a vision I'll never get out of my mind. And then obviously we had to go to work for the next 5 days. We had to bring President Obama and his wife in on Thursday, and then we had the big shootout that night in Watertown, and then I was the incident commander all day in Watertown when the city was shut down. And then someone mentioned to us they're hearing someone's in a boat, and literally myself and two of my guys, we were the first ones on that boat, and I could see him poking at the top inside the boat. And from that point on, you know, we had shots fired. We were able to control that. And working with the FBI hostage recovery team, we were able to get him out of the boat. Mm-hmm. And after 5 days and being a marathon, and you know, it was a great sense of satisfaction getting the people responsible. You know, I remember leaving Watertown. It's probably the best feeling I ever had as a police officer because everybody was out clapping, screaming. I think everyone was so relieved that we had the two individuals.
Yeah, and what was it like for you, Bill, just looking back at the... you must have been reviewing some of the CCTV footage and seeing these guys that were identified in it, and you saw where you had been running an hour or so earlier, people, you know, who, you know, were there just enjoying a day out and literally within minutes of their deaths.
Yeah, you know, I've seen the video numerous times of both suspects and the way they walk down the street and the way they drop their backpacks. And, you know, I'll always remember the second suspect who just got the death penalty, how he left that backpack behind that young family. And it always troubles me that he deliberately knew who he was going to blow up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've seen that film numerous times, and it's very difficult to look at, but those were two treacherous individuals who caused a lot of pain to people.
Bill Evans now says Boston is probably one of the safest cities in America and has implemented a very imaginative strategy in community policing.
It's safe. Most of the violence we have related gang on gang, so we don't have innocent people getting hurt at all. And over the last 5 years as commissioner, our crime went down 20%. But the best thing, and myself and Mayor Walsh like to highlight, is we locked up 30% less individuals in our city. So
crime went down, but also
30% of our arrests went down. So we're doing a lot of great things in community policing, such as we have our own ice cream truck, believe it or not.
Police ice cream truck.
Yeah, we bought our own truck, and it's the best way for our cops to interact with the younger kids. And if you told me 38 years ago that policemen would be riding around giving out ice creams, I'd say you're crazy. But, you know, we do all kinds of things. We do peace walks. We do coffee with a cop. We do flashlight walks. We do dancing with a cop. You name it. We're always trying to find innovative ways to be close. You know, we go to playgrounds. We go to senior events. We go all throughout the city bringing ice cream to residents. And it's a good way for the police and the public to interact. Nothing's better than a free ice cream and a good conversation.
And it just, it improves that kind of rapport that you have with people. And what about the importance of just having cops on the beat?
Well, it's important. Again, we having them on walking, having them on bikes, being able to interact with people, that's the only way you're going to earn people's trust and respect. It isn't riding around with your car window up. And, you know, it's about talking to the public, so they realize you're a real person. You know, I think sometimes police get a bad rap, especially in America, with where we've had some, you know, questionable shootings. You know, we're not all like that. We're parents, we're, you know, we're dads, aunts, uncles. We're human beings just trying to do a job.
Bill Evans with Sean O'Rourke. Well, in a week where the traveller community came under fire from Peter Casey during the presidential campaign, it was heartening to hear traveller culture being celebrated in the folk music documentary The Road Well Travelled. It was narrated by Niamh Dunn, who, apart from playing fiddle with Ed Sheeran's fave trad band Bioga, is a grandniece of the blind Dunn brothers, all renowned travelling musicians. In this extract, we join Niamh and her father, the piper Mickey Dunn from Limerick.
And then when Ed came calling, it kind of didn't seem like the right time to hang up the boots. There's an expression in the pop music industry, touched by the ginger hand of God. So Eamon Murray, our baron player, has shortened it to the Ginger Jesus. So we just call him the Ginger Jesus now. So we've been to Quilty and Milltown and out home to Carrickenlish, to Páirc Uí Chaoimh, to the studio with Bioga and all the little places in between. And there's a lot of depth in the stories that I've heard from my father in particular along the way here. And I think I kind of understand a little bit better and in a deeper way what I am made of and where I have come from and how I got to this place. And in a way, I think I'm just like the next cog in the ever-turning wheel as this goes forward. And, you know, Irish music and traditional music, it changes, it moves and it shifts. And I'm kind of really privileged to be part of taking that on to the next phase. Oh, the wild Atlantic way. That's deadly, isn't it? Deadly. If the weather was bad, though, it would have been kind of ropey enough, was it?
Look at the rabbits. It's full of rabbits. And that's where I stayed, and I could hear the sea, and I could hear it back those times as well. You can hear it. Mm. Isn't it lovely?
And you're coming down now, teaching at the same festival all the years later.
I've been teaching there now for the last 15 years, teaching at the Willie Clancy Week. No, it's just kind of gone full circle all the way around.
And brings back all the memories then, I suppose, of coming down.
But I always come out here. When I come down for the week, I come out here and I go down there where the boys used to park their caravans. And I sit there for a while and just think about it all, you know.
Say hello.
It's a totally different way. Like, everything has changed completely. Do you know? You'll never again see that.
Probably not.
Fiddle player Niamh Dunn and her father, piper Mickey Dunn, heard on Elizabeth Larrigy's documentary, The Road Well Travelled. The poet and playwright Vincent Woods was featured on a Sunday Miscellany special recorded at Culture Night in the National Museum in Dublin. Here he is with his own poem, Beckett on a Boreen.
Two men going home this night. One points to the sky. The sun, he says. The moon, says the other. No. The sun, the moon, the sun, the moon. The effin' sun, no, the feckin' moon. Moon, sun, sun, moon. and they lay into each other and tumble into the ditch, fighting and flailing. A third man comes by on his bike, stops, looks down at them in the ditch, and they pounce and pull him in. Point up. Sun or moon. And it's more like a threat than a question. "Oh, Jesus, lads," he says, "I wouldn't know. Sure, I'm not from around here."
Vincent Woods, as heard on Sunday Miscellany. Well, it's all about the big question, isn't it? The last book by renowned cosmologist Stephen Hawking, who died on the 14th of March this year, has just been published. It's called Brief Answers to the Big Questions. His daughter, Lucy Hawking, was Ray Darcy's guest on Wednesday.
Lucy, is there intelligent life elsewhere in the universe?
Well, so he thinks there's quite a high probability that there is intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. But the fact is, we haven't come across it yet. So we haven't been able to spot it. And there's this possibility that if intelligent life develops, it will reach a stage where it necessarily destroys itself. And therefore, while there may be other intelligent civilizations out there in the universe, it's possible that we're just not overlapping with them in the time frame. So that's one scenario. Yes. He gives the other scenario he gives, which is really interesting when you think about it, is that intelligence is not necessarily a byproduct of evolution. And he actually goes as far as to say that there's no, what is the clear survival advantage of intelligence? Bacteria are not intelligent, and they would probably survive even when the human race was wiped out.
Yeah, they'll outlive us. We will.
Yeah, exactly. So it's for a lot of interesting content in every chapter.
We'll engineer our own end due to our intelligence.
That's the frightening conclusion, isn't it? That intelligent civilizations are doomed to destroy themselves.
Lucy Hawking with Ray Darcy on Wednesday. 3 years ago, when Bjorn Sackers from Santry in Dublin was just 9 years old, his mother Lisa was diagnosed with breast cancer. And as he prepares for the ARC Torch of Hope relay taking place tomorrow, he told Evelyn O'Rourke how the CLIMB programme for children at ARC helped him and how he felt when he grew his hair long to help fundraise.
When I had it really long, it was heavy, it got in my eyes all the time. And now that it's gone, it's just so much easier.
And what happened to that beautiful hair?
It was given to Rapunzel, and they gave it to someone who needed that hair.
Tell us a little bit about why you decided to grow your hair 3 years ago.
Because my mom went through breast cancer, and I felt like it was a good thing to do.
Can you remember what it was like when you were first told your mom was sick?
I cried a bit, like a lot. I was worried about her.
You got involved with ARC.
Yeah. It was good. It distracted me. It's fun. It tells you what's going on. It's awesome.
And what kind of stuff did you do when you went into ARC for your climb evening?
Mainly art and talking about cancer, all the effects of it and stuff. We had to make a Rubik's Cube with 6 emotions on it.
And masks you enjoyed making?
Yeah, they were fun. I made 2. One was angry and he had big red eyebrows. The other one was sadness and he had really big blobs of blue.
And what was the point of the mask, do you think?
To show your emotions on something other than your face.
How tough did you find it that your mum was sick?
It was mainly confusing. I didn't really know what was going on, but kind of helped that. They explained a lot. I knew even the treatment she was going through.
And the thing around your mum losing her hair, was that something that you found difficult?
I didn't find it difficult because, well, I don't really care about her appearance, but she bought like 20 wigs.
And Soren?
Soren, he was worried, but he was 5. He didn't really know what was going on at all.
Having been through it all, what's your advice?
It gets better, I guess.
Evelyn O'Rourke reporting for the Today Show. Over on the History Show last Sunday evening, the subject was alcohol and Ireland and our long and complex relationship with the demon drink. Lass Fallon is a retired fireman and the official historian for Dublin Fire Brigade. He told Miles Dungan all about the Great Liberties Whiskey Fire of 1875, which occurred when a fire broke out at Malone's bonded warehouse on Chamber Street in Dublin. As the flames licked up and reached the wooden casks of liquor, they burst open and sent a river of piping hot whiskey gushing through the streets of the Liberties. The fire brigade, assisted by the military, used horse manure to stem the flow. And although nobody died in the fire itself, a number of people died later due to alcohol poisoning.
The dams were built across the street using the manure, and then it was spread on the street. So the burning whiskey is basically hitting this and starting to go out. It worked. It gave them access that the fire brigade could then get in and deal with the burning houses. But it also created an unholy mess on the streets. But within that unholy mess were 126,000 gallons of spirits.
Yeah, and thereby hangs a tale, because you talk about houses going on fire. There must have been wholesale panic, human dramas, flames everywhere.
That's right.
Nobody, however, died as a result of burns or smoke inhalation, but there were casualties.
The biggest fire in the 19th century in terms of financial loss, the biggest fire in terms of spread of area burned, the biggest fire in terms of loss of life. But again, as you say, nobody died in the fire. They made free with the 126,000 gallons of spirits which were lying around the streets. It was free drink from a very early stage. Huge crowds were pouring in to see it. It was a huge spectacle. Mm. You know, fires were big spectacles. But this was one with side benefits, because there was free drink to be had along with this. Now, the only thing you had
free
to
drink,
do...
If you didn't mind a free drink with dog feces and urine and animals' brains and horse manure.
Oh, there were drawbacks to it.
Yes.
I'll give you that. There were drawbacks to it.
But so there were people literally scooping this stuff up in their hands.
Scooping it with their hands. They were taking their shoes off and drinking it out of their boots. They were filling every pot and jam jar and receptacle of any description that could be had. There are reports of people on their hands and knees literally scooping it up until they collapse into it.
And how many people died?
13.
And it's the biggest...
Biggest loss of life in the 19th century in a fire in Dublin.
Even though nobody actually died in the fire.
From the History Show with Miles Dungan last Sunday evening. But I leave you now with a song from Mary Coughlan and Ulton Conlon, A Weak Heart Like Mine, written by Ulton. And they were Miriam O'Callaghan's guests last Sunday morning. Nive an clár an tochtan tógann de war hurry na dáchan, ach bé mé e caint liveríos an tochtan in níosin, gaidí sin, gaidí sib slán.
Lover, please don't leave me. I'm a good man. Can feel myself turning to put the wind at my back and the sun on my face.
Lover, won't you